I've noticed that so often our word to boys is don't. Don't climb on that. Don't break anything. Don't be so aggressive. Don't be so noisy. Don't be so messy. Don't take such crazy risks. But God's design, which he placed in boys as the picture of himself, is a resounding yes. Be fierce. Be wild. Be passionate. Now, none of this is to diminish the fact that a woman bears God's image as well. The masculine and feminine run throughout all creation. As Lewis says, gender is a reality, and a more fundamental reality than sex, a fundamental polarity which divides all created beings. There is the sun, and then there are the moon and stars. There is the rugged mountain, and there is the field of wildflowers that grows upon it. A male lion is awesome to behold, but have you ever seen a lioness? There is also something wild in the heart of a woman, but it is feminine to the core, more seductive than fierce. Even all her daughters are also a stem of that victorious stock, but in a wonderfully different way. As a counselor and a friend, and especially as a husband, I've been honored to be welcomed into the deep heart of Eve. Often when I am with a woman, I find myself quietly wondering, what is she telling me about God? I know he wants to say something to the world through Eve. What is it? And after years of hearing the heart cry of women, I am convinced beyond a doubt of this. God wants to be loved. He wants to be a priority to someone. How could we have missed this? From cover to cover, from beginning to end, the cry of God's heart is, why won't you choose me? It is amazing to me how humble, how vulnerable God is on this point. You will find me, says the Lord, when you seek me with all your heart. Jeremiah 29:13. In other words, look for me, pursue me, I want you to pursue me. Amazing. As Tozer says, God waits to be wanted. And certainly we see that God wants not merely an adventure, but an adventure to share. He didn't have to make us, but he wanted to. Though he knows the name of every star and his kingdom spans galaxies, God delights in being a part of our lives. Do you know why he often doesn't answer prayer right away? Because he wants to talk to us, and sometimes that's the only way to get us to stay and talk to him. His heart is for relationship, for shared adventure to the core. And yes, God has a beauty to unveil. There's a reason that a man is captivated by a woman. Eve is the crown of creation. If you follow the Genesis narrative carefully, you'll see that each new stage of creation is better than the one before. First, all is formless, empty and dark. God begins to fashion the raw materials like an artist working with a rough sketch or a lump of clay. Light and dark, land and sea, earth and sky, it's beginning to take shape. With a word, the whole floral kingdom adorns the earth. Sun, moon, and stars fill the sky. Surely and certainly, his work expresses greater detail and definition. Next come fish and fowl, porpoises and red-tailed hawks. The wild animals are next, all those amazing creatures. A trout is a wonderful creature, but a horse is truly magnificent. Can you hear the crescendo starting to swell, like a great symphony building and surging higher and higher? Then comes Adam, the triumph of God's handiwork. It is not to any member of the animal kingdom that God says, "You are my very image, the icon of my likeness." Adam bears the likeness of God in his fierce, wild, and passionate heart. And yet, there is one more finishing touch. There is Eve. Creation comes to its high point, its climax with her. She is God's finishing touch. And all Adam can say is, wow. Eve embodies the beauty and the mystery and the tender vulnerability of God. As the poet William Blake said, the naked woman's body is a portion of eternity too great for the eye of man. The reason a woman wants the beauty to unveil, the reason she asks, do you delight in me, is simply that God does as well. God is captivating beauty. As David prays, one thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. Psalm 27:4. Can there be any doubt that God wants to be worshipped? That he wants to be seen and for us to be captivated by what we see? As C.S. Lewis wrote, the beauty of the female is the root of joy to the female as well as to the male. To desire the enjoying of her own beauty is the obedience of Eve. And to both it is in the lover that the beloved tastes of her own delightfulness. This is far too simple an outline, I admit. There is so much more to say, and these are not hard and rigid categories. A man needs to be tender at times, and a woman will sometimes need to be fierce. But if a man is only tender, we know something is deeply wrong. And if a woman is only fierce, we sense she is not what she was meant to be. If you'll look at the essence of little boys and little girls, I think you'll find I am not far from my mark, strength and beauty. As the psalmist says, "One thing God has spoken, two things have I heard, that you, O God, are strong, and that you, O Lord, are loving." Psalm 62:11-12. Chapter 3. The question that haunts every man. The tragedy of life is what dies inside a man while he lives. Albert Schweitzer. He begins to die that quits his desires. George Herbert. Are you there? Say a prayer for the pretender, who started out so young and strong, only to surrender. Jackson Brown from The Pretender. Our local zoo had for years one of the biggest African lions I've ever seen. A huge male, nearly 500 pounds, with a beautiful mane and absolutely enormous paws. Panthera leo, the king of the beasts. Sure, he was caged, but I'm telling you, the bars offered small comfort when you stood within 6 feet of something that in any other situation saw you as an easy lunch. Honestly, I felt I ought to shepherd my boys past him at a safe distance, as if he could pounce on us if he really wanted to. Yet, he was my favorite, and whenever the others would wander on to the monkey house or the tigers, I'd double back just for a few minutes in the presence of someone so powerful and noble and deadly. Perhaps it was fear mingled with admiration. Perhaps it was simply that my heart broke for the big old cat. This wonderful, terrible creature should have been out roaming the savannah, ruling his pride, striking fear into the heart of every wildebeest, bringing down zebras and gazelles whenever the urge seized him. Instead, he spent every hour of every day and every night of every year alone, in a cage smaller than your bedroom, his food served to him through a little metal door. Sometimes, late at night, after the city had gone to sleep, I would hear his roar come down from the hills. It sounded not so much fierce, but rather mournful. During all of my visits, he never looked me in the eye. I desperately wanted him to, wanted for his sake the chance to stare me down, would have loved it if he took a swipe at me. But he just lay there, weary with that deep weariness that comes from boredom, taking shallow breaths, rolling now and then from side to side. For after years of living in a cage, a lion no longer even believes it is a lion, and a man no longer believes he is a man. A man is fierce, passionate, wild at heart. You wouldn't know it from what normally walks around in a pair of trousers. If a man is the image of the Lion of Judah, how come there's so many lonely women, so many fatherless children, so few men around? Why is it that the world seems filled with caricatures of masculinity? There's the guy who lives behind us. He spends his entire weekend in front of the tube watching sports while his sons play outside, without him. We've lived there 9 years, and I think I've seen him play with his boys maybe twice. What's with that? Why won't he engage? And the guy the next street over, who races motorcycles and drives a huge truck and wears a leather jacket and sort of swaggers when he walks. I thought James Dean died years ago. What's with him? It looks manly, but it seems cartoonish, overdone. How come when men look in their hearts, they don't discover something valiant and dangerous, but instead find anger, lust, and fear? Most of the time, I feel more fearful than I do fierce. Why is that? It was 150 years ago that Thoreau wrote, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation," and it seems nothing has changed. As the line from Braveheart has it, "All men die. Few men ever really live." And so most women lead lives of quiet resignation, having given up on their hope for a true man. The real life of the average man seems a universe away from the desires of his heart. There's no battle to fight, unless it's traffic and meetings and hassles and bills. The guys who meet for coffee every Thursday morning down at the local coffee shop and share a few Bible verses with each other, where's their great battle? And the guys who hang out down at the bowling alley, smoking and having a few too many, they're in the exact same place. The swords and castles of their boyhood have long been replaced with pencils and cubicles, the six-shooters and cowboy hats laid aside for minivans and mortgages. The poet Edwin Robinson captured the quiet desperation this way. Miniver Cheevy, child of scorn, grew lean while he assailed the seasons. He wept that he was ever born, and he had reasons. Miniver loved the days of old, when swords were bright and steeds were prancing. The vision of a warrior bold would set him dancing. Miniver Cheevy, born too late, scratched his head and kept on thinking. Miniver coughed and called it fate, and kept on drinking. Without a great battle in which a man can live and die, the fierce part of his nature goes underground and sort of simmers there in a sullen anger that seems to have no reason. A few weeks ago, I was on a flight to the West Coast. It was dinner time, and right in the middle of the meal, the guy in front of me drops his seat back as far as it can go, with a couple of hard shoves back at me to make sure. I wanted to knock him into first class. A friend of mine is having trouble with his toy shop because the kids who come in tick him off and he's snapping at them. Not exactly good for business. So many men, good men, confess to losing it at their own children regularly. Then there's the guy in front of me at the stoplight yesterday. It turned green, but he didn't move. I guess he wasn't paying attention. I gave a little toot on my horn to draw his attention to the fact that now there were 20-plus cars piling up behind us. The guy was out of his car in a flash, yelling threats, ready for a fight. Truth be told, I wanted desperately to meet him there. Men are angry, and we really don't know why. And how come there are so many sports widows losing their husbands each weekend to the golf course or the TV? Why are so many men addicted to sports? It's the biggest adventure many of them ever taste. Why do so many others lose themselves in their careers? Same reason. I noticed the other day that the Wall Street Journal advertises itself to men as adventures in capitalism. I know guys who spend hours online, e-trading stocks. There's a taste of excitement and risk to it, no question. And who's to blame them? The rest of their life is chores and tedious routine. It's no coincidence that many men fall into an affair not for love, not even for sex, but by their own admission, for adventure. So many guys have been told to put that adventurous spirit behind them and be responsible, meaning live only for duty. All that's left are pictures on the wall of days gone by, and maybe some gear piled in the garage. Ed Sisman writes, "Men past 40 get up nights, look out at city lights, and wonder where they made the wrong turn and why life is so long." I hope you're getting the picture by now. If a man does not find those things for which his heart is made, if he is never even invited to live for them from his deep heart, he will look for them in some other way. Why is pornography the number one snare for men? He longs for the beauty, but without his fierce and passionate heart, he cannot find her or win her or keep her. Though he is powerfully drawn to the woman, he does not know how to fight for her, or even that he is to fight for her. Rather, he finds her mostly a mystery that he knows he cannot solve, and so at a soul level, he keeps his distance. And privately, secretly, he turns to the imitation. What makes pornography so addictive is that more than anything else in a lost man's life, it makes him feel like a man without ever requiring a thing of him. The less a guy feels like a real man in the presence of a real woman, the more vulnerable he is to porn. And so a man's heart, driven into the darker regions of the soul, denied the very things he most deeply desires, comes out in darker places. Now, a man's struggles, his wounds and addictions, are a bit more involved than that. But those are the core reasons. As the poet George Herbert warned, he begins to die that quits his desires. And you know what? We all know it. Every man knows that something's happened, something's gone wrong. We just don't know what it is. I spent 10 years of my life in the theater as an actor and director. They were, for the most part, joyful years. I was young and energetic and pretty good at what I did. My wife was part of the theater company I managed, and we had many close friends there. I tell you this so that you will understand what I'm about to reveal. In spite of the fact that my memories of theater are nearly all happy ones, I keep having this recurring nightmare. This is how it goes. I suddenly find myself in a theater, a large, Broadway-style playhouse, the kind every actor aspires to play. The house lights are low and the stage lights full, so from my position on stage I can barely make out the audience, but I sense it is a full house. Standing room only. So far, so good. Actors love playing to a full house. But I am not loving the moment at all. I am paralyzed with fear. A play is underway, and I've got a crucial part, but I have no idea what play it is. I don't know what part I'm supposed to be playing. I don't know my lines. I don't even know my cues. This is every man's deepest fear, to be exposed, to be found out, to be discovered as an imposter, and not really a man. The dream has nothing to do with acting, that's just the context for my fear. You have yours. A man bears the image of God in his strength, not so much physically, but soulfully. Regardless of whether or not he knows the biblical account, if there's one thing a man does know, he knows he is made to come through. Yet he wonders, can I? Will I? When the going gets rough, when it really matters, will he pull it off? For years, my soul lived in this turmoil. I'd often wake in the morning with an anxiousness that had no immediate source. My stomach was frequently tied in knots. One day, my dear friend Brent asked, what do you do now that you don't act anymore? I realized at that moment that my whole life felt like a performance, like I am always on. I felt in every situation that I must prove myself again. After I spoke or taught a class, I'd hang on what others would say, hoping they would say it went well. Each counseling session felt like a new test. Can I come through again? Was my last success all that I had? One of my clients got a great promotion and a raise. He came in depressed. Good grief, I thought. Why? Every man longs to be praised and paid well on top of it. He confessed that although the applause felt great, he knew it only set him up for a bigger fall. Tomorrow, he'd have to do it all over, hit the ball out of the park again. Every man feels that the world is asking him to be something he doubts very much he has it in him to be. This is universal. I've yet to meet an honest man who won't admit it. Yes, there are many dense men who are wondering what I'm talking about. For them, life is fine and they are doing great. Just wait. Unless it's really and truly a reflection of genuine strength, it's a house of cards, and it'll come down sooner or later. Anger will surface, or an addiction, headaches, an ulcer, or maybe an affair. Honestly, how do you see yourself as a man? Are words like strong, passionate, and dangerous words you would choose? Do you have the courage to ask those in your life what they think of you as a man? What words do you fear they would choose? I mentioned the film Legends of the Fall, how every man who's seen it wants to be Tristan, but most see themselves as Alfred or Samuel. I've talked to many men about the film Braveheart, and though every single one of them would love to be William Wallace, the dangerous warrior hero, most see themselves as Robert the Bruce, the weak, intimidated guy who keeps folding under pressure. I'd love to think of myself as Indiana Jones. I'm afraid I'm more like Woody Allen. The comedian Garrison Keillor wrote a very funny essay on this in his The Book of Guys. Realizing one day that he was not being honest about himself as a man, he sat down to make a list of his strengths and weaknesses. Useful things I can do. Be nice. Make a bed. Dig a hole. Write books. Sing alto or bass. Read a map. Drive a car. Useful things I can't do. Chop down big trees and cut them into lumber or firewood. Handle a horse, train a dog, or tend a herd of animals. Handle a boat without panicking the others. Throw a fastball, curve, or slider. Load, shoot, and clean a gun, or a bow and arrow, or use either of them, or a spear, net, snare, boomerang, or blowgun, to obtain meat. Defend myself with my bare hands. Keillor confesses, maybe it's an okay report card for a person, but I don't know any persons. For a guy, it's not good. A woman would go down the list and say, what does it matter if a guy can handle a boat, throw a curveball, bag a deer, throw a left hook? This is 1993. But that's a womanly view of manhood. Craig and I were joking about this as we hacked our way through grizzly-infested woods in Alaska. The only other guys we met all day were a group of locals on their way out. They looked like something out of Soldier of Fortune magazine. Sawed-off shotguns, pistols, bandoliers of ammo slung across their chests, huge knives. They were ready. They had what it takes. And we? We had a whistle. I'm serious. That's what we brought for our dangerous trek through the wild. A whistle. Talk about a couple of pansies. Craig confessed, "Me? What can I really do? I mean, really. I know how to operate a fax machine." That's how most men feel about their readiness to fight, to live with risk, to capture the beauty. We have a whistle. You see, even though the desires are there for a battle to fight, an adventure to live, and a beauty to rescue, even though our boyhood dreams once were filled with those things, we don't think we're up to it. Why don't men play the man? Why don't they offer their strength to a world desperately in need of it? For two simple reasons. We doubt very much that we have any real strength to offer, and we're pretty certain that if we did offer what we have, it wouldn't be enough. Something has gone wrong, and we know it. What's happened to us? The answer is partly back in the story of mankind, and partly in the details of each man's story. Why does God create Adam? What is a man for? If you know what something is designed to do, then you know its purpose in life. A retriever loves the water. A lion loves the hunt. A hawk loves to soar. It's what they were made for. Desire reveals design, and design reveals destiny. In the case of human beings, our design is also revealed by our desires. Let's take adventure. Adam and all his sons after him are given an incredible mission. Rule and subdue. Be fruitful and multiply. Here is the entire earth, Adam. Explore it. Cultivate it. Care for it. It is your kingdom. Oh, talk about an invitation. This is permission to do a heck of a lot more than cross the street. It's a charter to find the equator. It's a commission to build Camelot. Only Eden is a garden at that point. Everything else is wild so far as we know. No river has been charted. No ocean crossed. No mountain climbed. No one's discovered the molecule, or fuel injection, or Beethoven's Fifth. It's a blank page waiting to be written, a clean canvas waiting to be painted. Most men think they are simply here on Earth to kill time, and it's killing them. But the truth is precisely the opposite. The secret longing of your heart, whether it's to build a boat and sail it, to write a symphony and play it, to plant a field and care for it, those are the things you were made to do. That's what you're here for. Explore, build, conquer. You don't have to tell a boy to do those things for the simple reason that it is his purpose. But it's going to take risk and danger. And there's the catch. Are we willing to live with the level of risk God invites us to? Something inside us hesitates. Let's take another desire. Why does a man long for a battle to fight? Because when we enter the story in Genesis, we step into a world at war. The lines have already been drawn. Evil is waiting to make its next move. Somewhere back before Eden, in the mystery of eternity past, there was a coup, a rebellion, an assassination attempt. Lucifer, the prince of angels, the captain of the guard, rebelled against the Trinity. He tried to take the throne of heaven by force, assisted by a third of the angelic army, in whom he instilled his own malice. They failed and were hurled from the presence of the Trinity. But they were not destroyed, and the battle is not over. God now has an enemy, and so do we. Man is not born into a sitcom or a soap opera. He is born into a world at war. This is not Home Improvement. It's Saving Private Ryan. There will be many, many battles to fight on many different battlefields. And finally, why does Adam long for a beauty to rescue? Because there is Eve. He is going to need her, and she is going to need him. In fact, Adam's first and greatest battle is just about to break out as a battle for Eve. But let me set the stage a bit more. Before Eve is drawn from Adam's side and leaves that ache that never goes away until he is with her, God gives Adam some instructions on the care of creation and his role in the unfolding story. It's pretty basic and very generous. You may freely eat any fruit in the garden, except fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Genesis 2:16-17. Okay, most of us have heard about that. But notice what God doesn't tell Adam. There is no warning or instruction over what is about to occur, the temptation of Eve. This is just staggering. Notably missing from the dialogue between Adam and God is something like this. Adam, one more thing. A week from Tuesday, about 4 PM, you and Eve are going to be down in the orchard and something dangerous is going to happen. Adam, are you listening? The eternal destiny of the human race hangs on this moment. Now, here's what I want you to do. He doesn't tell him. He doesn't even mention it, so far as we know. Good grief, why not? Because God believes in Adam. This is what he's designed to do, to come through in a pinch. God doesn't need play-by-play instructions, because this is what Adam is for. It's already there, everything he needs, in his design, in his heart. Needless to say, the story doesn't go well. Adam fails. He fails Eve and the rest of humanity. Let me ask you a question. Where is Adam while the serpent is tempting Eve? He's standing right there. She also gave some to her husband, who was with her. Then he ate it too. Genesis 3:6. The Hebrew for with her means right there, elbow to elbow. Adam isn't away in another part of the forest. He has no alibi. He is standing right there, watching the whole thing unravel. What does he do? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. He says not a word, doesn't lift a finger. He won't risk, he won't fight, and he won't rescue Eve. I'm indebted to Crabb, Hudson, and Andrews for pointing this out in the silence of Adam. Our first father, the first real man, gave in to paralysis. He denied his very nature and went passive. And every man after him, every son of Adam, carries in his heart now the same failure. Every man repeats the sin of Adam every day. We won't risk, we won't fight, and we won't rescue Eve. We are truly a chip off the old block. Lest we neglect Eve, I must point out that she fails her design as well. Eve is given to Adam as his ezer kenegdo, or as many translations have it, his helpmeet or helper. Doesn't sound like much, does it? It makes me think of hamburger helper. But Robert Alter says this is a notoriously difficult word to translate. It means something far more powerful than just helper. It means lifesaver. The phrase is only used elsewhere of God when you need him to come through for you desperately. There is no one like the God of Jeshurun who rides on the heavens to help you. Deuteronomy 33:26. Eve is a life giver. She is Adam's ally. It is to both of them that the charter for adventure is given. It will take both of them to sustain life, and they will both need to fight together. Eve is deceived, and rather easily, as my friend Jan Myers points out. In The Allure of Hope, Jan says, Eve was convinced that God was withholding something from her. Not even the extravagance of Eden could convince her that God's heart is good. When Eve was deceived, the artistry of being a woman took a fateful dive into the barren places of control and loneliness. Now every daughter of Eve wants to control her surrounding, her relationships, her God. No longer is she vulnerable. Now she will be grasping. No longer does she want simply to share in the adventure. Now she wants to control it. And as for her beauty, she either hides it in fear and anger, or she uses it to secure her place in the world. In our fear that no one will speak on our behalf, or protect us, or fight for us, we start to recreate both ourselves and our role in the story. We manipulate our surroundings so we don't feel so defenseless. Fallen Eve either becomes rigid or clingy. Put simply, Eve is no longer simply inviting. She is either hiding in busyness or demanding that Adam come through for her. Usually, an odd combination of both. Adam knows now that he has blown it, that something has gone wrong within him, that he is no longer what he was meant to be. Adam doesn't just make a bad decision. He gives away something essential to his nature. He is marred now. His strength is fallen, and he knows it. Then what happens? Adam hides. I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. Genesis 3:10. You don't need a course in psychology to understand men. Understand that verse, let its implications sink in, and the men around you will suddenly come into focus. We are hiding, every last one of us. Well aware that we too are not what we were meant to be, desperately afraid of exposure, terrified of being seen for what we are and are not, we have run off into the bushes. We hide in our office, at the gym, behind the newspaper, and mostly behind our personality. Most of what you encounter when you meet a man is a facade, an elaborate fig leaf, a brilliant disguise. Driving back from dinner one night, a friend and I were just sort of shooting the breeze about life and marriage and work. As the conversation deepened, he began to admit some of the struggles he was having. Then he came out with this confession. The truth is, John, I feel like I'm just bluffing my way through life, and that someday soon I'll be exposed as an imposter. I was so surprised. This is a popular, successful guy who most people like the moment they meet him. He's bright, articulate, handsome, and athletic. He's married to a beautiful woman, has a great job, drives a new truck, and lives in a big house. There's nothing on the outside that says, not really a man. But inside, it's another story. It always is. Before I ever mentioned my nightmare about being on stage with nothing to say, another friend shared with me that he too is having a recurring nightmare. It involves a murder and the FBI. Apparently, in his dream, he has killed someone and buried the body out back of his house. But the authorities are closing in, and he knows that at any moment they'll discover the crime scene and he'll be caught. The dream always ends just before he is found out. He wakes in a cold sweat. Any day now, I'll be found out is a pretty common theme among us guys. Truth be told, most of us are faking our way through life. We pick only those battles we are sure to win, only those adventures we are sure to handle, only those beauties we are sure to rescue. Let me ask the guys who don't know much about cars. How do you talk to your mechanic? I know a bit about fixing cars, but not much. And when I'm around my mechanic, I feel like a weenie. So what do? I fake it. I pose. I assume a sort of casual, laid-back manner I imagine the guys use when hanging around the lunch truck, and I wait for him to speak. Looks like it might be your fuel mixture, he says. Yeah, I thought it might be that. When was the last time you had the carb rebuilt? Oh, I don't know, it's probably been years. I'm guessing he's talking about my carburetor, and I have no idea if it's ever been rebuilt. Well, we'd better do it now, or you're going to end up on some country road miles from nowhere, and then you'll have to do it yourself. Yeah, I say casually, as if I don't want to be bothered again having to rebuild that thing, even though I know I wouldn't have the slightest idea where to begin. All I have is a whistle, remember? I tell him to go ahead, and he sticks out his hand, a big, greasy hand that says, I know tools real well, and what am I supposed to do? I'm dressed in a coat and tie because I'm supposed to give a talk at some women's luncheon, but I can't say, gee, I'd rather not get my hands dirty, so I take his hand and pump it extra hard. Or how about you fellows who work in the corporate world? How do you act in the boardroom when the heat is on? What do you say when the big boss is riding you hard? Jones, what the devil is going on down there in your division? You guys are 3 weeks late on that project. Do you try to pass the buck? Actually, sir, we got the plans over to McCormick's department to bid the job weeks ago. Do you feign ignorance? Really? I had no idea. I'll get right on it. Maybe you just weasel your way out of it. That job's a slam dunk, sir. We'll have it done this week. Years ago, I did a tour of duty in the corporate world. The head man was a pretty intimidating guy. Many heads rolled in his office. My plan was basically to try and avoid him at all costs. When I did run into him in the hallway, even in friendly conversation, I always felt about 10 years old. How about sports? A few years ago, I volunteered to coach for my son's baseball team. There was a mandatory meeting that all coaches needed to attend before the season to pick up equipment and listen to a briefing. Our recreation department brought in a retired professional pitcher, a local boy, to give us all a pep talk. The posing that went on was incredible. Here's a bunch of balding dads with beer bellies sort of swaggering around, talking about their own baseball days, throwing out comments about pro players like they knew them personally, and spitting, I kid you not, their attitude. That's a tame word, was so thick I needed waiters. It was the biggest bunch of posers I've ever met outside the church. That same sort of thing goes on Sunday mornings. It's just a different set of rules. Dave runs into Bob in the church lobby. Both are wearing their happy faces, though neither is happy at all. "Hey, Bob, how are you?" Bob is actually furious at his wife and ready to leave her, but he says, "Great, just great, Dave. The Lord is good." Dave, on the other hand, hasn't believed in the goodness of God for years, ever since his daughter was killed. "Yep, God is good, all the time. I'm just so glad to be here, praising the Lord." "Me too. Well, I'll be praying for you." I would love to see a tally of the number of prayers actually prayed against the number of prayers promised. I bet you it's about 1 in 1,000. "And I'll be praying for you too. Well, gotta go. You take care." Take care is our way of saying, "I'm done with this conversation and I want to get out of here, but I don't want to appear rude, so I'll say something that sounds meaningful and caring." But in truth, Dave doesn't give a rip about Bob. Adam falls and all his sons with him. After that, what do you see as the story unfolds? Violent men or passive men? Strength gone bad. Cain kills Abel. Lamech threatens to kill everyone. God finally floods the earth because of the violence of men, but it's still going on. Sometimes it gets physical. Most of the time it's verbal. I know Christian men who say the most awful things to their wives, or they kill them with their silence, a cold, deadly silence. I know pastors, warm and friendly guys in the pulpit, who from the safety of their office send out blistering emails to their staff. It's cowardice, all of it. I was intrigued to read in the journals of Civil War commanders how the men you thought would be real heroes end up just the opposite. "Roughs that are always ready for street fighting are cowards on the open battlefield," declared one corporal. A sergeant from the same division agreed. "I don't know of a single fist-fighting bully but what he makes for a cowardly soldier. The violence, no matter what form, is a cover-up for fear." What about the achievers, the men running hard at life, pressing their way ahead? Most of it is fear-based as well. Not all of it, but most of it. For years, I was a driven, type A, hard-charging perfectionist. I demanded a lot of myself and those who worked for me. My wife didn't like to call me at work, for as she said, "You have your work voice on." In other words, your fig leaf is showing. All that swaggering and supposed confidence and hard charging came out of fear. The fear that if I did not, I would be revealed to be less than a man. Never let down, never drop your guard, give 150%. Achievers are a socially acceptable form of violent men, overdoing it in one way or another. Their casualties tend to be their marriages, their families, and their health. Until a man faces this honestly and what's really behind it, he'll do great damage. And then there's the passive men. Abraham is a good example. He's always hiding behind his wife's skirt when the going gets rough. When he and his household are forced by a famine down to Egypt, he tells Pharaoh that Sarah is his sister, so he won't get killed. He jeopardizes her in order to save his own skin. Pharaoh takes Sarah into his harem, but the whole ruse is exposed when God strikes the Egyptians with diseases. You'd think Abraham would have learned his lesson, but no, he does it again years later when he moves to the Negev. In fact, his son Isaac carries on the tradition, jeopardizing Rebekah in the same way. The sins of the father passed along. Abraham is a good man, a friend of God, but he's also a coward. I know many like him, men who can't commit to the women they've been dragging along for years, men who won't stand up to the pastor and tell him what they really think. Pastors and Christian leaders who hide behind the fig leaf of niceness and spirituality and never, ever confront the difficult situation. Guys who organize their paper clips. Men who hide behind the newspaper or the television and who won't really talk to their wives or children. I'm like him too, a true son of Abraham. I mentioned that the early years of our life in the theater were good ones, but that's not the full story. I also had an affair with my work. I married my wife without ever resolving or even knowing the deeper questions of my own soul. Suddenly, the day after our wedding, I am faced with the reality that I now have this woman as my constant companion, and I have no idea what it really means to love her, nor if I have whatever it is she needs from me. What if I offer her all I have as a man, and it's not enough? That's a risk I was not willing to take. But I knew I had what it took at the theater. And so slowly, I began to spend more and more time there. Late nights, weekends, eventually, every waking moment. I was hiding, like Adam, running from the fact that my strength was being called for, and I really doubted I had any. The evidence is clear. Adam and Eve's fall sent a tremor through the human race. A fatal flaw entered the original, and it's been passed on to every son and daughter. Thus, every little boy and every little girl comes into the world set up for a loss of heart. Even if he can't quite put it into words, every man is haunted by the question, am I really a man? Have I got what it takes when it counts? What follows is the story we are personally much, much more familiar with. Chapter 4. The Wound. Little Billy's mother was always telling him exactly what he was allowed to do and what he was not allowed to do. All the things he was allowed to do were boring. All the things he was not allowed to do were exciting. One of the things he was never, never allowed to do, the most exciting of them all, was to go out through the garden gate all by himself and explore the world beyond. Roald Dahl, The Minpins. In the clearing stands a boxer and a fighter by his trade, and he carries the reminders of every glove that laid him down and cut him till he cried out in his anger and his shame, I am leaving, I am leaving. But the fighter still remains. Paul Simon, The Boxer. I believe I was the only one in the entire company to come all the way through Normandy without getting wounded. Private William Craft, 314th Infantry Regiment. The story of Adam's fall is every man's story. It is simple and straightforward, almost mythic in its brevity and depth. And so every man comes into the world set up for a loss of heart. Then comes the story we are much more aware of, our own story. Where Adam's story seems simple and straightforward, our own seems complex and detailed. Many more characters are involved, and the plot is sometimes hard to follow. But the outcome is always the same, a wound in the soul. Every boy, in his journey to become a man, takes an arrow in the center of his heart, in the place of his strength. Because the wound is rarely discussed, and even more rarely healed, every man carries a wound. And the wound is nearly always given by his father. On a warm August afternoon several years ago, my boys and I were rock climbing in a place called Garden of the Gods, near our home. The red sandstone spires there look like the dorsal fins of some great beast that has just surfaced from the basement of time. We all love to climb, and our love for it goes beyond the adventure. There's something about facing a wall of rock, accepting its challenge, and mastering it that calls you out, tests and affirms what you are made of. Besides, the boys are going to climb everything anyway, the refrigerator, the banister, the neighbor's grape arbor, so we might as well take it outside. And it's an excuse to buy some really cool gear. Anyway, when I climb with the boys, we always top rope, meaning that before the ascent, I'll rig protection from the top of the rock down, enabling me to belay from the bottom. That way, I can coach them as they go, see their every move, help them through the tough spots. Sam was the first to climb that afternoon, and after he clipped the rope into his harness, he began his attempt. Things were going well until he hit a bit of an overhang, which, even though you're roped in, makes you feel exposed and more than a little vulnerable. Sam was unable to get over it and began to get more and more scared the longer he hung there. Tears were soon to follow. So with gentle reassurance, I told him to head back down, that we didn't need to climb this rock today, that I knew of another one that might be more fun. No, he said, I want to do this. I understood. There comes a time when we simply have to face the challenges in our lives and stop backing down. So I helped him up the overhang with a bit of a boost. And on he went with greater speed and confidence. Way to go, Sam. You're looking good. That's it. Now reach up to your right. Yep, now push off that foothold. Oh, nice move. Notice what a crucial part of any male sport this sort of shop talk is. It's our way of affirming each other without looking like we're affirming. Men rarely praise each other directly as women do. Ted, I absolutely love your shorts. You look terrific today. We praise indirectly by way of our accomplishments. Whoa, nice shot, Ted. You've got a wicked swing today. As Sam ascended, I was offering words of advice and exhortation. He came to another challenging spot, but this time sailed right over it. A few more moves and he would be at the top. Way to go, Sam. You're a wild man. He finished the climb, and as he walked down from the back side, I began to get Blaine clipped in. 10 or 15 minutes passed, and the story was forgotten to me. But not Sam. While I was coaching his brother up the rock, Sam sort of sidled up to me and in a quiet voice asked, "Dad, did you really think I was a wild man up there?" Miss that moment, and you'll miss a boy's heart forever. It's not a question. It's the question, the one every boy and man is longing to ask. Do I have what it takes? Am I powerful? Until a man knows he's a man, he will forever be trying to prove he is one, while at the same time shrink from anything that might reveal he is not. Most men live their lives haunted by the question, or crippled by the answer they've been given. In order to understand how a man receives a wound, you must understand the central truth of a boy's journey to manhood. Masculinity is bestowed. A boy learns who he is and what he's got from a man or the company of men. He cannot learn it any other place. He cannot learn it from other boys, and he cannot learn it from the world of women. The plan from the beginning of time was that his father would lay the foundation for a young boy's heart and pass on to him that essential knowledge and confidence in his strength. Dad would be the first man in his life and forever the most important man. Above all, he would answer the question for his son and give him his name. Throughout the history of man given to us in Scripture, it is the father who gives the blessing and thereby names the son. Adam receives his name from God and also the power of naming. He names Eve, and I believe it is therefore safe to say he also names their sons. We know Abraham names Isaac, and though Isaac's sons Jacob and Esau are apparently named by their mother, they desperately crave the blessing that can only come from their father's hand. Jacob gets the blessing, and nearly a century later, leaning on his staff, he passes it on to his sons. He gives them a name and an identity. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. Issachar is a raw-boned donkey. Dan will be a serpent. Gad will be attacked by a band of raiders, but he will attack them at their heels. Joseph is a fruitful vine. His bow remained steady. The Baptist's father names him John, even though the rest of the family was going to name him after his father, Zechariah. Even Jesus needed to hear those words of affirmation from his father. After he is baptized in the Jordan, before the brutal attack on his identity in the wilderness, his father speaks, "You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." Luke 3:22. In other words, "Jesus, I am deeply proud of you. You have what it takes." One father-naming story in particular intrigues me. It centers around Benjamin, the last son born to Jacob. Rachel gives birth to the boy, but she will die as a result. With her last breath, she names him Benoni, which means son of my sorrow. But Jacob intervenes and names him Benjamin, son of my right hand. This is the critical move, when a boy draws his identity no longer from the mother, but from the father. Notice that it took an active intervention by the man. It always does. A boy is brought into the world by his mother, and she is the center of his universe in those first tender months and years. She suckles him, nurtures him, protects him. She sings to him, reads to him, watches over him, as the old saying goes, like a mother hen. She often names him as well, tender names like my little lamb or mama's little sweetheart or even my little boyfriend. But a boy cannot grow to manhood with a name like that, let alone a name like son of my sorrow. And there comes a time for the shift when he begins to seek out his father's affection and attention. He wants to play catch with dad and wrestle with him, spend time outside or in his workshop. If dad works outside the home, as most do, then his return in the evening becomes the biggest event of the boy's day. Stacy can tell you when it happened for each of our boys. This is a very hard time in a mother's life, when the father replaces her as the son of the boy's universe. It is part of Eve's sorrow, this letting go, this being replaced. Few mothers do it willingly. Very few do it well. Many women ask their sons to fill a void in their soul that their husband has left. But the boy has a question that needs an answer, and he cannot get the answer from his mother. Femininity can never bestow masculinity. My mother would often call me sweetheart, but my father called me tiger. Which direction do you think a boy would want to head? He will still turn to his mother for comfort. Who does he run to when he skins his knee? But he turns to Dad for adventure, for the chance to test his strength, and most of all, to get the answer to his question. A classic example of these dueling roles took place the other night. We were driving down the road, and the boys were talking about the kind of car they want to get when it comes time for their first set of wheels. I was thinking about a Humvee or a motorcycle, maybe even a tank. What do you think, Dad?
I'd go with the Humvee. We could mount a machine gun on top.
What about you, Mom? What kind of car do you want me to have?
You know what she said?
A safe one. Stacy is a wonderful mother. She has bit her tongue so many times I wonder that she still has one, as she holds her peace while the boys and I rush off to some adventure begging destruction or bloodshed. Her first reaction, a safe one, is so natural, so understandable. After all, she is the incarnation of God's tenderness. But if a mother will not allow her son to become dangerous, if she does not let the father take him away, she will emasculate him. I just read a story of a mother, divorced from her husband, who was furious that he wanted to take the boy hunting. She tried to get a restraining order to prevent him from teaching the boy about guns. This is emasculation.
My mom wouldn't let me play with G.I. Joe, a young man told me.
Another said, we lived back east, near an amusement park. I had a roller coaster, the old wooden kind, but my mom would never let me go. That is emasculation, and the boy needs to be rescued from it by the active intervention of the father, or another man. This kind of intervention is powerfully portrayed in the movie A Perfect World. Kevin Costner plays an escaped convict who takes a young boy hostage and heads for the state line. But as the story unfolds, we see what looks like the boy's ruin is actually his redemption. The boy is in his underpants when Costner abducts him. That is where many mothers want to keep their sons, albeit unconsciously. She wants her little lamb close by. Over the days that follow, days together on the road, I might add, Costner and the boy, who has no father, grow close. When he learns that the boy's mother has never allowed him to ride a roller coaster, Costner is outraged. The next scene is the boy, arms high in the air, rolling up and down country roads on the roof of the station wagon. That's the invitation into a man's world, a world involving danger. Implicit in the invitation is the affirmation. You can handle it. You belong here. There comes a moment when Costner buys the boy a pair of pants. The symbolism in the film is amazing. But the boy won't change in front of him. He is a shy, timid boy who has yet to even smile in the story. Costner senses something.
What's the matter? You don't want me to see your pecker?
It's puny.
What?
It's puny.
Who told you that?
The boy, Philip, is silent. It is the silence of emasculation and shame. The absence of the father's voice is loud and clear. So Costner intervenes and speaks.
Let me see. Go on, I'll shoot you straight.
The boy reluctantly bears himself.
No, Philip, that's a good size for a boy your age.
A smile breaks out on his face, like the sun coming up, and you know a major threshold has been crossed for him. Masculinity is an essence that is hard to articulate, but that a boy naturally craves as he craves food and water. It is something passed between men. The traditional way of raising sons, notes Robert Bly, which lasted for thousands and thousands of years, amounted to fathers and sons living in close, murderously close, proximity. While the father taught the son a trade, perhaps farming or carpentry or blacksmithing or tailoring. My father taught me to fish. We would spend long days together, out on a boat, on a lake, trying to catch fish. I will never, ever forget his delight in me when I'd hook one. But the fish were never really the important thing. It was the delight, the contact, the masculine presence gladly bestowing itself on me.
Attaboy, tiger. Bring him in. That's it. Well done.
Listen to men when they talk warmly of their fathers, and you'll hear the same. My father taught me to fix tractors, to throw a curveball, to hunt quail. And despite the details, what is mostly passed along is the masculine blessing. Fathers and sons in most tribal cultures live in amused tolerance of each other, says Bly. The son has a lot to learn, and so the father and son spend hours trying and failing together to make arrowheads or to repair a spear or track a clever animal. When a father and son spend long hours together, which some fathers and sons still do, we could say that a substance almost like food passes from the older body
to the younger. This is why my boys love to wrestle with me, why any healthy boy wants the same with his father. They love the physical contact, to brush against my cheek, feel the sandpaper of my whiskers, my strength all around them, to test theirs on me. And it's that testing that is so essential. As they've gotten older, they love to start punching matches with me. Luke just did it this morning. I'm downstairs fixing breakfast. Luke senses the opportunity, and he sneaks downstairs and silently stalks me. When he's in range, he lets loose a wallop. It hurts, and they need to see that it hurts. Do they have a strength like Dad's? Is it growing, real, substantive? I'll never forget the day when Sam gave me a bloody lip, quite by accident, when we were wrestling. At first, he drew back in fear, waiting, I'm sorry to admit, for my anger. Thankfully, on this occasion, I just wiped the blood away, smiled, and said, "Oh, nice shot." He beamed. No, he strutted. Shook his antlers at me. Word quickly spread through the house, and his younger brothers were on the scene, eyes wide at the fact that one of them had drawn blood. New possibilities opened up. Maybe young bucks can take on the old bull. The ancient societies believed that a boy becomes a man only through ritual and effort, only through the active intervention of the older men, Bly reminds us. The father or another man must actively intervene, and the mother must let go. Bly tells the story of one tribal ritual, which involves, as they all do, the men taking the boy away for initiation. But in this case, when he returns, the boy's mother pretends not to know him. She asks to be introduced to the young man. That is a beautiful picture of how a mother can cooperate in her son's passage to the father's world. If she does not, things get very messy later, especially in marriage. The boy develops a bond with his mother that is like emotional incest. His loyalties are divided. That is why Scripture says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife." Genesis 2:24. Sometimes, when the mother clings, the boy will try to tear himself away, violently. This typically comes in teenage years and often involves some ugly behavior, maybe some foul words on the part of the young man. She feels rejected and he feels guilty, but he knows he must get away. This was my story, and my relationship with my mother has never been good since. I found that many, many adult men resent their mothers but cannot say why. They simply know that they do not want to be close to them. They rarely call. As my friend Dave confessed, "I hate calling my mom. She always says something like, 'It's so good to hear your little voice.' I'm 25 and she still wants to call me her little lamb." Somehow, he senses that proximity to his mother endangers his masculine journey, as though he might be sucked back in. It is an irrational fear, but it reveals that both essential ingredients in his passage were missing. Mom did not let go, and Dad did not take him away. Whatever the mother's failure, it can be overcome by the father's engagement. Let's come back to the rock climbing story with Sam. "Did you really think I was a wild man up there?" He did not ask, "Do you think I'm a nice boy?" He asked about his strength, his dangerous capacity to really come through. A boy's passage into manhood involves many of those moments. The father's role is to arrange for them, invite his boy into them, keep his eye out for the moment the question arises, and then speak into his son's heart, "Yes, you are. You have what it takes." And that is why the deepest wound is always given by the father. As Buechner says, "If strangers and strange sights can shake the world of children, it takes the people they know and love best to pull it out from under them like a chair." Dave remembers the day the wound came. His parents were having an argument in the kitchen, and his father was verbally abusing his mother. Dave took his mom's side, and his father exploded. I don't remember all that was said, but I do remember his last words. "You're such a mama's boy," he yelled at me. Then he walked out. Perhaps if Dave had a strong relationship with his dad most of the time, a wound like this might be lessened, healed later by words of love. But the blow came after years of distance between them. Dave's father was often gone from morning till night with his own business, and so they rarely spent time together. What is more, Dave felt the lingering disappointment from his dad. He wasn't a star athlete, which he knew his dad highly valued. He had a spiritual hunger and often attended church, which his dad did not value. And so, those words fell like a final blow, a death sentence. Leanne Payne says that when the father-son relationship is right, the quiet tree of masculine strength within the father protects and nurtures the fragile stripling of masculinity within his son. Dave's father took an axe and gave his hardest blow to his young tree. How I wish it were a rare case, but I am deeply sorry to say I've heard countless stories like it. There's a young boy named Charles who loved to play the piano, but his father and brothers were jocks. One day they came back from the gym to find him at the keyboard. This had built up years of scorn and contempt in his father's soul, but his son received both barrels. "You're such a faggot." A man my father's age told me of growing up during the Depression. Times were hard for his family, and his father, an alcoholic rarely employed, hired him out to a nearby farmer. One day while he was in the field, he saw his father's car pull up. He hadn't seen him for weeks, and he raced to meet his dad. Before he could get there, his father had grabbed the check for his son's wages and, spying the boy running toward him, jumped in the car and sped away. The boy was 5 years old. In the case of violent fathers, the boy's question is answered in a devastating way. "Do I have what it takes? Am I a man, Papa?" "No, you are a mama's boy, an idiot, a faggot, a seagull." Those are defining sentences that shape a man's life. The assault wounds are like a shotgun blast to the chest. This can get unspeakably evil when it involves physical, sexual, or verbal abuse carried on for years. Without some kind of help, many men never recover. One thing about the assault wounds, they are obvious. The passive wounds are not. They are pernicious, like a cancer. Because they are subtle, they often go unrecognized as wounds, and therefore are actually more difficult to heal. My father was in many ways a good man. He introduced me to the West and taught me to fish and to camp. I still remember the fried egg sandwiches he would make us for dinner. It was his father's ranch that I'd worked on each summer, and my dad and I saw a lot of the West together as we'd make the long drive from Southern California to Oregon, often with fishing detours through Idaho and Montana. But like so many men of his era, my father had never faced the issues of his own wounds, and he fell to drinking when his life began to take a downhill turn. I was about 11 or 12 at the time, a very critical age in the masculine journey, the age when the question really begins to surface. At the very moment when I am desperately wondering what it means to be a man and do I have what it takes, my father checked out, went silent. He had a workshop out back, attached to the garage, and he would spend his hours out there alone, reading, doing crossword puzzles, and drinking. That is a major wound. As Bly says, not receiving any blessing from your father is an injury. Not seeing your father when you are small, never being with him, having a remote father, an absent father, a workaholic father, is an injury. My friend Alex's father died when he was 4 years old. The sun in his universe set, never to rise again. How was a little boy to understand that? Every afternoon, Alex would stand by the front window, waiting for his father to come home. This went on for almost a year. I've had many clients whose fathers simply left and never came back. Stuart's dad did that, just up and left, and his mother, a troubled woman, was unable to raise him. So he was sent to his aunt and uncle. Divorce or abandonment is a wound that lingers because the boy, or girl, believes if they had done things better, Daddy would have stayed. Some fathers give a wound merely by their silence. They are present, yet absent to their sons. The silence is deafening. I remember as a boy wanting my father to die and feeling immense guilt for having such a desire. I understand now that I wanted someone to validate the wound. My father was gone, but because he was physically still around, he was not gone. So I lived with a wound no one else could see or understand. In the case of silent, passive, or absent fathers, the question goes unanswered. Do I have what it takes? Am I a man, Daddy? Their silence is the answer. I don't know. I doubt it. You'll have to find out for yourself. Probably not. Every man carries a wound. I have never met a man without one. No matter how good your life may have seemed to you, you live in a broken world full of broken people. Your mother and father, no matter how wonderful, couldn't have been perfect.